You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
So tonight, we are so very pleased to have 10 talented writers share their work with us, two from each of the five participating schools. The names of our readers and the order of the reading is listed in the program that you picked up on the way in. And in addition to our readers, I'd like to especially thank all of the professors from Otis, USC, CalArts, UC Irvine, and UC Riverside for collaborating with us and for helping put this program together. Thank you. And like all programs, tonight's program will be recorded for podcast and made available for free via iTunes or the LA Public Library website. And you can also check out our extensive archive of past Aloud programs there. And so onward, enjoy hearing from the voices that are writing our future, and thank you for being a part of LA's rich literary community, whom we welcome to the LA Public Library. Let's give a round of applause to our first reader, Alex Dupree.
Thanks. I'm going to read five poems. Four short ones, and then a not-so-short one. Honeymoon phase. After the adulthood I was telling myself of, I was in absolute sexual fear. The refusal of clandestine borders, that they might be crossed. And television was incessant. What did I remember of paradise, or the green colors of the river where I swam? You mostly, who were my companion, you who also had to learn to want to be happy. The oppressors. They write letters of complaint regarding the fine print of cable contracts as their wives vacuum around them. They meet at Jax's Hot Donuts at a pink corner booth reserved for them to trade and verify preseason rumors, and in each other recognize unsober years, a glint impervious to this excessive habit over suffering. They are the caretakers of suffering. They bury it until it forms a kind of power like petroleum in them, wheezing next to their radios, while summer wind disturbs their blinds, and bank passwords on slips of paper flutter through their houses. HBO at the Garden Inn. That Alexander wept for having no more worlds to conquer is from Die Hard, not Plutarch, who in fact says the opposite. On hearing the number of worlds was endless, Alexander wept for not having conquered even one. Immobile in his armor, he turned his blurry gaze south, or maybe east, a dog cocking its hind leg up to scratch a matted ear, while palms tottered in the breeze. Either way, there was weeping, the world being one, or one of many, both good reasons for it. This poem is called King Spa. The band, Stephen and Asia, and Chris and the Texas people are sprawled in the unisex room of the Jimjilbong, best in the city, in a circle on the heated floor. Identical white robes on everybody, I should say on everybody's body, like the sleeping congregants of some hangover cult, who take pleasure in refusal. We take pleasure in refusal. If rain is falling, we can't hear it. If the sun is up, or setting earlier how it has been these days, who knows? Casino rules apply. The city outside is an idea, enduring barely, like two contrails above the wheat field, where we unrolled our camouflage nets and blankets and have been trying to fall asleep for 1,000 years. This poem is called Only the Perfect. Only the perfect map is useless, full to scale, with every minuscule detail, every hair on the taut backs of the wild crouching seawall cats rendered in perfect motion capture CGI, with every grain of sand recorded, coinciding perfectly at every point, each bit of trash and every pair of shoes that ever swung from telephone wires. So exact it terrifies, or would, only the perfect map is hidden, like a perforated stratum just below the surface, like a flesh-pink carbon copy receipt set thinly beneath us and beneath each passing thought, picking up traces of them in the midst of Sunday traffic, makeshift soccer games, the crowded park, all etched into a diaphanous, please retain for your records, map. Attentive as a perfect lover and as unforgiving. And no help to me, combing the earth for you. Lost with only a perfect map, or just stories of it, really. From those who glimpse it where it ripples, gently, like a parachute. Where even the bureaucracy of angels whose job it is can't hide a latency between the perfect sky and these craggy bright clouds, its docked red cargo ships and these, between the you I saw and you, a difference almost beauty. The way a dancer's perfect waist, upside down in the ceiling mirror, as she crawls, pushing crumpled dollar bills across the stage, is just uncanny or mannequin enough to make sex sexy and love lovely, is just a hint of things ajar, a door through which what is remembered, what has been kept, vouchsafed, even the life I had with you that I remember, can come into this place or, I guess, go from it again. Only the perfect grapes that Zeuxis painted, so real that all the crows who, squawking, came to tear apart the canvas, learned the disappointment of desire. Only the perfect grapes cannot be eaten, but can be, you said, something to love. To vanish into, like steam into a shirt. The map, you said, will keep us. It is perfect. Only the perfect map is lacking what we also wish to lack. In weight, resistance, as with one princely swipe of one finger, I zoom across impossible deserts, the graves, the gravel paths, villages outside of Kabul, little tallies of dirt road, high-value targets, lives innumerable, all seen as if from above and perfect. There, the metonymic pixel is a hat, the hat a man, the man a perfect man. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Howard Ho. I'll be reading two pieces. The Golden Age. I'm here at the Golden Age retirement home to pick up a 100-year-old woman known to me only as Teacher Two. My mother has asked me to take her to a banquet where she is to be honored. I arrive, but she doesn't pick up the phone or answer the door, and so I go down the hall to visit my grandmother, who I call Nai Nai. I don't see Nai Nai nearly enough, and this promises to ease my guilt. Nai Nai is 94 years old, and every muscle and limb on her aches with pain. My grandfather died a few years ago, and since then she's been alone in the tiny one-bedroom apartment on the second floor. Despite this, her mind remains brilliant, and she remembers to give me pictures. Stacked in a deck, I see photos of myself, barely a 5-year-old knee-high dimpled sprite, the sweater I wore saying varsity, for a sport I hadn't yet played. I came at the right moment, 6 years after my older cousin was born and 6 years before another cousin would follow. Nai Nai had immigrated in her 60s when I was 2. it helped that the older cousin was still back in Taiwan, making me the default choice for affection. She's lived in the Golden Age ever since I can remember, and everything from the green and red pagoda architecture to the koi pond remains unchanged. As the young sprite, I roamed its hallways, alert to potential new grandmas around every corner, ready with sweets and smiles. My own grandma was no exception, her ancient Chinese bronzeware made of plastic, a decidedly formal cover for the pile of white rabbit candies inside. In those days, my grandfather would watch Chinese opera on tape. Ignorantly, I dismissed the music as trash can banging and would retire to the bedroom where I could watch my own tape. And really, the only tape available to me, in English anyway, was The Last Emperor, which, as a film essentially about a spoiled Chinese boy, suited me perfectly. The depictions of suicide, nudity, and drug use, while inappropriate for this adolescent, were tolerated because my grandparents were glad I was watching something, anything vaguely Chinese. More often, I'd be watching reruns of Gilligan's Island, which Nai Nai would call Marianne, after the one I had a crush on. She also called popsicles circles, which I never understood, but now I see was a sonic approximation of the word popsicle. The upshot of living in an ethnic enclave, both the Golden Age and the surrounding Monterey Park, known as Little Taipei, is that she never learned much English. But back in Taiwan, she was a grade school teacher. Sometimes she would sit me down to recite poetries and stories in Mandarin after Saturday morning Chinese school, and in turn, I would coach her as she watched Learning English on Channel 18. Today she's not feeling well, but I'm more alarmed at a mound of several dozen Tupperware containers piled in the living room. The ungainly sight brings to mind hoarding. Nai Nai quickly assures me it's there on account of a bug infestation that required an emptying of the cupboards. I relax, not at the news of bugs, but at the fact she is still aware enough of my discomfort to diffuse it. Ah, she remembers something. She shows me these pictures she's been meaning to give me. Besides the ones of the future varsity hopeful, I see a couple shots of my grandfather playing the jinghu, a two-string Chinese fiddle. He's leading a band in the Chinese opera I once mocked. Back then, it was a noisy distraction impeding my regularly scheduled programming, but now it's my pedigree, the only familial connection I have to an artist. I tell her I want the pictures. Nai Nai registers my interest, perhaps more than a little surprised, and says, sure, they're mine now. These were the last things she ever gave me. I remember to go back and check in with teacher two, who Nai Nai says is not all there in the head. That's saying something coming from a 94-year-old. I bid goodbye to Nai Nai the last time I'd see her at the Golden Age and not in a hospital. I go back to try teacher two's door. This time she answers, a sprite herself now, but one I recognize as a towering figure from my hallway roaming days. With halting Chinese, I tell her that we need to go to an event where she's being honored and that I'm her driver. What event is that? Teacher two says. I hand her the ticket, which she studies for a description of the event. It looks fun. I'll buy a ticket, teacher two says. I say this is her ticket and that she should come with me. Sure, when? She says. Now, I say. After this negotiation, I manage to convince the frail centenarian to be escorted into my car, which makes me feel not unlike a kidnapper. Having done my duty, I drive off with the precious cargoes, teacher two in the passenger seat, and my fiddle-playing grandfather in my coat pocket. Ballad of a Tabby Man. The man with the hat, who couldn't feel the wind in his hair because he was wearing a hat, picks up a paper to read, but the wind keeps folding the pages, so he goes inside a bar near the light to read when his face lights up from the light and he can see himself in the mirror and leans in to inspect his unshaven chin when he knocks over a drink which spills all over the mirror and the paper and he no longer sees himself and the bartender asks, "What can I get for you?" And the man says, "A towel to wipe the mirror." And the bartender says, "No, to drink." And the man says, "Something dry?" And the bartender pours a bourbon, which the man uses to wipe the mirror and his throat, which he now see has grown bearded ever since he stopped shaving to avoid buying razors.
making him look like a cat with sunken eyes, and he can't afford this drink of towel-replacing whiskey, but slinks crawling stealthily to the door when the bartender mentions the tab and sees the tabby man halfway out the bar before he can say it's on the house, and the man's beard is getting clogged with refuse from the floor because he's ducking down and sneezes from pollen as he exits the bar back onto the street, pollinating a nearby bud, and he wipes off his beard where he finds a 10-cent piece and, excited, looks for more, and huddled in an alley, scavenges his fur for change and comes up with enough to buy a razor, except he likes the beard now, what with its stealth and wealth potentials. And he folds the coin into his right hand, making a tight fist that from a bearded man seems belligerent, enough so that passersby are frightened and the cops are called and arrive, and the man does the don't shoot hands in the air, dropping his precious metals, which the cops hear clink and think for a second could be a gun, a bomb, an atomic weapon, an Islamic threat to our Christian ways, and they draw their weapons until the man says, "I'll pay for the bourbon," and the cops are taken aback and see that the man is referring to some legal tender with the words, "In God we trust," and know this man means no harm, but the man sees the guns and runs anyway, not wanting to look back lest he lose his stride, his muscles ache on only a shot of bourbon in his veins, an emaciated lion defiantly pollinating stray flora, thinking about that article in the paper he was just trying to read in the light about shoot first, trigger happy coppers. It was only then when he noticed his hat was no longer on his head. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Casey Taylor, and I'm going to be reading from the last half of a longer story called Pull. And when this section begins, a married couple is walking on the beach. It's a cold, windy day, and there aren't a lot of other people present. They were almost to the parking lot when they came upon the family. The woman, tall and rotund, stood close to the water, her arms wrapped around a baby in a striped onesie. Two girls ran in and out of the waves. The older one looked to be 7 or 8 and held the hand of the younger, who couldn't have been more than 3. As they drew closer, Kate slowed to watch the girls, the woman, the baby. It took Adam a moment to notice she was no longer beside him. When he did, he stopped walking, glanced around to see what had caused her delay. He followed her gaze, then turned to study a piece of driftwood, waiting for her to begin again. Kate knew he was waiting. 2 more seconds, she thought, and she'd be ready. The children ventured farther into the water. It lapped against the older girl's stomach, almost to the younger girl's shoulders. An oncoming wave sent them both running toward the shore, but the younger girl was not fast enough. She was still in up to her waist when the wave pushed her forward into the water and rolled over her. Another wave crested just after. The water ran back out toward the ocean, and the child did not resurface. The mother cried out, gestured to her older daughter to go back, but the girl was laughing, running from the waves, and couldn't hear her mother over the wind. The woman was large, her hands full with the baby. She was moving slowly. There was still no sign of the child. Then Kate was running, past the woman, past the older girl, who had by now seen her mother's face and come to a confused halt, past the shallows and into the water with her flip-flops and her long skirt. Kate moved her arms in sweeping motions through the water, felt her legs stiffen as the tide pulled at her skirt in its race away from the beach. Her fingers combed through grit, cold and hard. Her back ached. She was about to straighten, to change position, when her hand grazed something soft, something that did not yet belong to the ocean. She grasped harder, fingers gripping cloth and skin. The muscles in her arm straining against the current's toe, she lifted the girl out of the water. A head appeared, skin several shades darker than Kate's own. A face, eyelashes that clung together, freckles. Fingers clenched into fists, knees, toes all came out of the ocean as Kate lifted the girl higher. The child's mouth was open, but it took several chokes and gasps before she began crying. Water poured down her face and clothes. A circlet of fine hair sprung up and away from her forehead. Her eyes opened. They were brown, with flecks of green. Had the flecks been there before the fall, Kate wondered, or were they a vestige, a keepsake of her time in the water? She pulled the girl to her chest, felt the child's arms and legs encircle her. She waded back to the beach where the older sister stood, silent and subdued, next to the woman, hands still full with the baby she held. Kate's steps were heavy, her skirt drenched and clinging to her legs. Both of them, she and the little girl, smelled of salt. She could see Adam still standing by the driftwood looking out to her. The light was behind him. She couldn't see the expression on his face, and after a moment, she had to look down. The wind was too biting. It hurt her eyes. She reached the beach, the mother and the other girl. And now the older child became upset. Her face crumpled as she looked at her sister in Kate's arms, and she turned and clawed at her mother, arms stretched high in a plea to be picked up. The woman tried with one arm to comfort her, holding the baby with the other, and she met Kate's eye, shook her head. Kate realized the woman couldn't take the little girl, but she didn't want to put the child in the sand either. She was soaking wet, her arms and legs still wrapped tightly around Kate. "Parking lot?" Kate yelled, trying to project her voice over the wind. And the woman nodded, following her up the beach, gripping both her other children, trying to tell her something, every third word stolen by a gust of air. "Thank you so. I was about," promised that she told her, "thank you, thank you." Adam met them at the edge of the parking lot. He reached down from his perch on the dunes, several feet higher, gesturing for Kate to hand him the child. She shook her head no, scrambled up the sand in one sandal. She must have lost the other in the water. The woman led them to a rusting station wagon, two car seats in the back. She struggled to open the front door, the wind pushing against her, and she held it open with her body as she argued with her older daughter, finally persuading the girl to let go and get into the car. The woman pulled open the back door, and the baby began to scream and twist as she buckled him into one of the car seats. The woman put a broad hand on his stomach, pushed him deeper into the seat before tightening his straps. She closed the door, then turned to Kate, looked at her expectantly. They stood facing each other, the other woman's arms finally empty. Kate felt her grip on the child tighten, saw the woman's eyes flicker to her hands, then back to her face. Adam came up beside her. Before she realized what he was doing, his hands were around the little girl's waist and he was lifting her away. For a moment, Kate didn't let go, and they held the child together, as if frozen in some family portrait gone wrong, while the woman watched and the baby screamed from his car seat. "Jesus, Kate," Adam whispered under his breath. "Stop it." The little girl squirmed, and Kate relaxed her grip. Adam passed the girl over to the woman. The woman took her, moved to the other side of the car with the child in her arms, her face displaying her confusion at the awkwardness of the moment, at Kate's hesitation, and Kate could only stand there, absorbing the bewilderment in the other woman's gaze. Then Adam had his hand at the small of Kate's back. He was leading her away from the family and toward their own car, new, silver, too large. He escorted her to the passenger side door, opened it for her, and with a hand on top of her head, guided her down and into the seat, as if she was 9 years old, or 90. The door slammed shut. Silence for the first time that morning. The interior was dry and warm. Adam walked back around the car and opened the driver's side door, the wind shrieking into her space until he shut it out again. Silence, two of them now, both breathing heavily. Adam again, "Jesus, what is wrong with you?" Water dripped from her hair and dress onto the seat and floor mats. She shook her head. When they reached the house, Kate took a shower while Adam cooked. Fettuccine, grilled tomatoes, and zucchini from his garden. After several bites, she picked up her plate and carried it to the sink. Scraping the pasta down the disposal, she left the dish on the counter. A few minutes later, Adam followed her into the living room, where she sat in the rocking chair holding a magazine, a mug of water next to her on the coffee table. He cleared his throat, and when she didn't look up, sat down across from her and opened a book. They read, rarely turning pages, for 20 minutes. Adam threw his book down. "How about we go to brunch tomorrow?" he said. "We could check out the new place next to the park you've been wanting to try." Kate did not lift her eyes from the words before her. "No," she said. She went to bed at 9. She did not tell him she was going, but he joined her soon after. She turned to the wall as he moved about the room, as his weight pushed the mattress downward, as he shifted in search of a comfortable position. She listened to the rise and fall of his breath and felt the movement of the ocean's waves, even though she had been in the water for hardly any time at all. She was tired, but knew she would not sleep. The image in her mind was too strong. Her hands, white and small beneath the water, sweeping through the current, bringing forth a child from the ocean's racing pull. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Nico Nelson, and I will be reading a few poems. Eureka. Archimedes has his breast on the seal of a woman's head in Sacramento, watching pilgrim ships sail down northern rivers to a republic rising again with a breast-bearing bear. Archimedes has his breast on the seal of maternity hotels, fostering leaders unmodeled after females, included in points of interest, motivated by droughts lessening the quickness of a crop raid, aided by a map serving 38 million golden users, to which I Love You, California plays no more. Nomenclature. This is the beginning of nominal streets and roving, dead flowers crawling into butterflies, where people aren't as they were but are sane, doing the same job in the Rockies, doing what can be done in the flats. I'll need more reasons only the flats have, but only in the Rockies can there be reason in an unchanged crevice, where the mountain is only a friend of age, weeping out wisdom barked into my porous skin, hung from my lungs for lifetimes. Waiting at the cabin. I miss California, but rather have a job than review. Rather watch my chin bleed on tarmac than own a boutique. Rather hop fences here than wear shoes. I'm trying to get out the door, my dog the lampshade I can't provide my father, in Vermont sleeping on days-old pizza from Chicago, while I sit on a broken ledge waiting for my dog to jump into the lake, knowing he never will. They wait exclusively, and since I can't deliver, I've got time to die. I lose because of my name. I get on a ship with a rocket man, though I ain't him in the 14 years of almost there and got us nowhere near. Tired of trying, stopped because who counted? I used pewter in the cereal today. I put on the red light to reach the other men still waiting, who will take it when I don't give. I was thanked for my submissiveness, but the line's too short for the thought, so I've begun writing on my hair and tearing the paper out. On Sunday, the sunshiners will rush the gates until morning catches onto unburst clouds, lightly soothing the whitest ring of hurts, giving up unmarshaled. At the lighthouse, farmers keeping seeds without water and snowflakes, unwithered straight all night. Because no one hears me, Peru is soaked in the Arco Iris, wonder oh wonder, cold collecting clean dust fields, steady as definitions, burning the deepest bone, tossing, panting, choking, inviting the dead to bed with me. Settling with sun vigor, the ministers of night, playing folk songs, pursuing veins. Each day seeing for the first time, Chinatown is sunny, chilly Sunday morning. Dead fish, cold ice, hard men, almost women. Finding reasons, wondering if living is a Presidio and the Tenderloin. The blood system finds a way to lose face in a world-class bed. This concrete here smells like some sweet sugar roses. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ben Sneed. I'm going to be reading a short essay called Finding Mercy, Part 1. My dad has a phrase he likes to throw around as if it were commonplace, but I've never heard anyone else use it. It's like a cat licking a grindstone. For years growing up, I wasn't quite sure what it meant. I don't remember much about when I finally asked. I only know I was about 14, and I was at a stage where I thought I knew everything, so running into something I didn't know was always frustrating. Dad wasn't the kind of guy you ran to when you needed an answer to a question. He was stoic and no nonsense. We were putting up hay in the barn, saving it for the winter, when I finally said, "What does like a cat licking a grindstone mean?" He came down from the loft where he was stacking bales, walked over to the other side of the barn, where a bunch of old tools sat, most of them unused for decades, and ran his first finger along the grindstone wheel. "See these pits," he said. "That's where cats used to come lick the salt out of the stone. It takes a long time. It means something takes a long time." Then he walked back towards the loft and climbed the ladder, resumed stacking hay bales for the winter. I knew it would be one of those days that would take forever, and I figured out why Dad used the expression so often. Every day was like that for him, but that was a day I've never forgotten. I wondered how I could be better than him if slated for a life like his. I wondered if it would make me cold, but the small account he'd just given, the time he'd taken that he never took. Maybe there were answers to finding those moments, stringing them together in succession. Maybe I could find humanity, find mercy and understanding in the cracks between long days and brutality, between resignation and depression. Part two. Killing something is never easy, or at least that's what I think about it. I heard a lot growing up that it gets easier the more you do it, but I think maybe that's a load of horse shit. Once my uncle and dad decided they could save some money and kill a bull themselves. Most of the time, we had the slaughterhouse do it, but they'd started charging outrageous fees. We've argued who was even there, including me, but it's now become family mythology, a family story, something we mention in different modes, mom in anger, me in wonder, dad in guilt. We can never agree on the details, but this is how I remember it. I was sitting inside the trailer, looking out one of those ratty trailer bay windows. Dad and my uncle had decided they could get a .22 bullet through the bull's skull, which would then tear around in its brain and make the death less painful, or some other ill-guided reason. Actually, I'm not sure why they were so dead set on the .22. If it had been me, I would have said, just put him down. Seems I can recall those words, less painful, come up when Mom and Dad got ornery, Mom unsure the .22 would do the job, and Dad being stubborn, partly because she was being so stubborn. That's how fights go in my family. But it's interesting when people think about how to lessen the violence of an aggression, how they sometimes think about the pain they're going to cause, and then, fueled by necessity, turn around and cause it anyway. The story goes really that the .22 bullet did not go through the bull's skull, which ended up giving the animal more pain. They shot him again and the bull still didn't go down, then a third time. Dad ran towards the trailer and came bursting through the door. He went to his room and came back with a big rifle, probably a .30-06. He didn't even make it down to the bull. There was a hard pain in his face, solidarity maybe. The bull was thrashing. I had heard many a cow moo, even holler, and bawl, but never scream, which this bull did, making sounds only something dying can. I know this because I've seen an animal or two die, and they all make a noise you won't hear anywhere except there on that threshold. Even a catfish squeals. Dad took aim from where he stood, sighting down the scope of the gun, and his shot went straight into the bull's head, where a small spray of blood erupted, then painted the bull's white face red. The animal fell silent. I saw Dad's chest inflate as he finally breathed. When it was all over, I didn't know what was violence and what was mercy. Sometimes when I recall that memory, I'm still not sure I do. At least at the intersections where they meet, where they blend into confusion. Only in a cruel land with no right answers. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bridget Clerkin, and I'm going to read a short scene from a longer story. Irene has been told to write three paragraphs on something important that someone has told her. Then she must address the source of the statement's authority. Why do you trust this person? What has given this statement its power? She thinks about Rebecca telling her that when one stands up, one's thighs must not meet, must not rub, must not touch. This is a good way to assess not just that specific area of the body, but the overall quality of one's figure. If one's inner thighs do not touch, the rest of the body is probably suitably proportioned. If not, there is sweat and chafing, a high probability of heat rash, a general flabbiness, and a lack of intent. Rebecca has not said it in so many words, but Irene knows Rebecca believes that to be taken seriously, women must not only have intent, but convey it, reek of it, practically. Irene's mother had intent in those last moments, but they took it from her, said her death was an accident, unintentional. Next to Irene, Nan Gould is scribbling away. Her mouth is open, so she looks like she is breathing heavily as she writes. Irene expects Nan's tongue to come flapping out. Nan is probably writing something cliche, like something President Truman has said or sound advice she has heard from her parents. Sometimes, if the train car is crowded and Irene is sitting, and if Rebecca is standing before her with a hand on the strap, Irene wants to slide her hand flat up and between to see if Rebecca's thighs rub together. Would her hand get stuck where the thighs meet? Or would her hand keep going, free to travel the length of Rebecca's legs? That would be a good way to test the statement's legitimacy and the speaker's authority. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily Ansara Baines, and I will be reading the beginning of a story called How to Understand What Happened. The bedroom door closes behind him with a crisp click. It is the sound of bones snapping in two. His footsteps echo down the hall. For a recent assignment, your teacher had you draw a map of your home. Now you imagine him walking through the map, his footsteps black blemishes on the bright Crayola shades. He turns left into the kitchen. You think of it as your mother's office. She is there now. You listen to the amiable murmurs of their chat. Usually, you find your mother's voice comforting. A sniff of the air suggests she's making chicken marsala, your favorite. Tonight, you will barely touch it. He jokes with your mother about your massive Barbie collection. He says he has never seen a kid with so many toys. This was the reason for his visit to your room. Usually, he stays in their garage, where he has been building an addition for a steal. You thought stealing was bad, and said so, and your parents laughed, and that look blossomed on their faces, the one that meant you'll understand when you're older. You feel older. Your mother corrects him. Only some of the toys are Barbies. Most of your collection is made up of porcelain dolls. Some of them, the ones your mother won't let you touch, the ones that live on the highest shelf, are antiques. They are worth real money. If you touch them, you will be in big trouble. Your mother asks him to name his favorite doll. He pauses. You hold your breath. Maybe he will tell her what happened. Then you won't have to. He says, the brunette one, and your mother teases his lack of specificity. She is an English teacher, after all. He clears his throat and says he's got to get going to beat traffic. Your mother wishes him good luck. The front door closes. In the map you drew, the front door had a frowny face. When your teacher asked why, you explained that you were sad when people left your home. A human, you now realize, can be a toy, bent and manipulated at will. You pull the head off your favorite Barbie with barely a flick of your wrist. You bury the decapitated body in your sock drawer. Cupping the head in your hand, you cover Barbie's eyes with your thumb. You make a game of it. Now you see me, now you don't. The Barbie head falls to the floor. It rolls under your unmade bed and comes to a standstill, eyes staring out. You wash yourself in the shower and do not ask for help. You're a big kid now. You just did a big kid thing. Before, when you showered with your mother, you found the air too hot and too humid. You couldn't breathe, and you would whine and slap your mother's leg until she turned down the heat. But now the shower is not hot enough. Your skin tingles but still doesn't feel right. Only when the steam sets off the smoke alarm do you finally feel relaxed, the siren screaming all that you have held back. Your mother comes running into the bathroom, holding a wooden spoon covered in red sauce. She doesn't have time for your shenanigans. Dinner is still not ready, and it is almost 6. Then your mother sees your peeling skin, and her face scrunches up real tight. When you step out of the shower, the hairs on your arms stick out straight, and you shiver. Your mother wraps you in a towel and asks what's the matter. You stare at the ground as the tomato sauce drips like blood on the tile. The words are wrong and fuzzy in your mouth. You invent code names for the parts of the body. Your vagina is V. Your chest is BB. The shower is still running, but now your mother is too. Your mother puts you to bed. She does not know what else to do. On your bedside table is a plate of sugar cookies and a glass of milk, as if you are being rewarded. From the other room, your little brother whines that it's not fair, and your mother tells him to hush. The police don't know how to look at you. To make it easier, you don't look at them. Your mother buys you 3 new dolls. They are nicer than your other ones, even nicer than the dolls you are not allowed to touch. They wear silk dresses and come with little matching hand muffs that remind you of polar bears. Perched at the edge of your bed, your mother explains in the same soft voice she uses to tell you bedtime stories that the dolls were hand-painted by a man in France. You will have to be careful with them. They are not meant to be touched. She glances at you, but you can handle it, right? Her eyes are glassy and spilling. Water drips down her cheek and onto the dolls. She doesn't bother to wipe it away. You don't reply. As your mother lavishes attention on these new recruits, you feel bad for the other dolls. She places the red-haired one in your lap and urges you to play. The Barbie head still rests under your bed. After your mother leaves, you stuff the 3 dolls deep into your closet, behind the trolls and an unopened game of Battleship. Your father comes home early from his business trip. He forgets your souvenir. He never forgets your souvenir. When you point this out, your father blinks rapidly and calls for your mother. You wake up and hear your parents arguing about what to do. The lawyer delivers the good news. You do not have to go to court. He will act as your proxy once your parents sign some papers. Of course your parents will sign the papers. No 8-year-old should be put through something as traumatic as a day in court. You are asked to videotape a statement. It won't take long, the lawyer promises. If you're lucky, you will be back at school in time for the Thanksgiving parade. You're one of only 4 pilgrims in your 2nd grade class. Everyone else wanted to be the wild Indians. Your brother hides in his bedroom playing video games. You knock and ask if you can play. He never have agreed to in the past, but he knows you went through something terrible and that he should be kind. You play poorly, and though your brother can beat all the kids in the grade above him, he lets you win. This feels worse than losing. Your mother finds the Barbie's headless body in your sock drawer. You are once again called into your father's office. This time you remain standing as your parents suggest you see a head doctor to help with your emotions. You don't feel very emotional, and you say so. Your parents confess that they worry you feel bad because of what happened, even though it's not your fault. The head doctor gives you crayons and a large piece of construction paper. You draw kittens and houses with triangle roofs. You are certain you say nothing of interest. Your mother moves into the guest bedroom. The lawyer asks you to describe what happened. He gently reminds you not to look at the camera. The camera, studies have shown, frightens children. You will be more comfortable and therefore honest if you speak directly to him. Then he prompts you with words that still make you blush. Afterwards, your mother offers to stop for ice cream, but you want to get back in time for the parade. Your teacher smiles real big when you walk into the classroom. For the first time, you notice one of her front teeth is crooked, and you wonder if she will need braces. You raise your hand, and she immediately calls your name. When you ask if you can be an Indian after all, she blinks her big watery eyes and tells you to go nuts. Years pass. You continue to go nuts. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Emily Dorf, and I'll be reading 5 poems. Of course, what this means is we won't have a baby now, no chance to clip the antique silver sweater clip, 2 smiling long-beaked birds I polished when my mother gave it to me, simple, a little object, or to leave me. Just these shiny silver birds. No, baby. Oh, how much I. An electrocution in Piqua, Ohio. The baby crawled under the sink, ate the rat poison. The boy got tumbled from the tractor, split his arm till the bone stuck out. The only response to the sight was to vomit, then pull on socks. It wasn't unusual for the 15-year-old to build a silo. wood sides he had to bend, so he took a metal rod to wrap them. High up, power wires crossing like some vague war over rural America. It was just a moment, palm, metal, wire. And then he was a thin balloon pulled up by fire, or the tip of a leaf on an alder tree, or a god. That is to say, from the sky he saw himself falling and had to bear the distance. To cut and pull the backbone from a chicken. What must it do to the butcher, the woman, the one who holds the little held together body, which moves in its own way, with its muscles still and its tendons and its bones? When I did this, I wished for silver poultry shears, but I did it with a knife. The greatest men know you can flatten a soul with a little knife, while the world outside is bursting with ivy. What must one think to drive a tank to the square that is bursting with flowers? Call to the square the butcher, the woman, the astronomer. Oh, astronomer, what must the world look like to you? Is it a glistening purple olive? I'm weeping for what I didn't know but did. Tonight, they will not serve the usual at the Golden Pear. This next poem is addressed to a man named Wenceslas. Some years ago, I rented what had been his apartment from one of his family members. They still owned it. And when I moved in, I realized that this family member hadn't changed anything in the apartment except the duvet on the bed. Wenceslas, I have moved into your apartment, furnished as it was before your death. There are five black pens still on your desk. Two oils, beautiful by someone who struggled like me. Everything and old. The bed, the pewter plate on the wall your mother gave, engraved with your saint name, his horse with long ribbons. Someone promised us long ago that he'd save us again. Instead, I kneeled in the tub to bathe in cold water. Did you see me, splayed upon the washroom floor, listening through the window, onto which everyone's windows opened? So I heard two people making love, as you must have too, clearly and without shame. To keep the wings safe. When the local library has a sale, dimes or quarters for books, I go buy enough to fill the shelves. I bake the books first at 170 degrees, or as low as the oven will go, for an hour. Place a sheet pan of water on the bottom rack, and this gets rid of many bugs. So I might open the pages one day, and just 1,000 iridescent elytra might not open too. Poem, what can I do? It is next to that bookcase that my lover of years tells me he's hated me for many months. I'd wanted a baby, but now all I have is the memory of my own mother, overwrought, pushing a puzzle we'd been building off the table with one wild swing of her forearm. Its pieces, multitudinous wings, dropped to the floor, slowly, and, can I say this, beautifully.
Hello, my name is Cecilia Latule. I will be reading a story called Getting Propositioned in a Starbucks in Encino. You approached the front door of the cafe, taking care with each step so your dress moved with you in time. You were very good at that, you know. The practicing paid off. Thank goodness your apartment had that poorly attached full-length mirror at the end of the hallway. It had been so easy to pry it off the wall and prop it next to the television that played Cat on a Hot Tin Roof time and again. Imitation was your method, and Elizabeth taught you everything. The group of older gentlemen were playing cribbage on the cafe patio in their usual spot. Did they ever purchase drinks, you wondered? Of course not. You liked them and the civility their playing ritual brought. They seemed the sort of men who looked with kind eyes, eyes that had a sense of what was important and what was exceptional nowadays. They comforted you. They'd been staring at you as your low heels had clicked evenly on the pavement. You looked down, then shyly up, and smiled a young smile, a smile that held in a breathlessness, a national velvet smile. They nodded back at you. They didn't need to say anything, you decided. They could just look. The Starbucks was busy, just as you had thought it would be. You had come in thinking this place was beneath you. Now you made use of it, standing there with your shoulders back, chin held high, feet turned out, one in front of the other like a 50s fashion model. There. You adjusted your shawl, tossed one end carefully but carelessly over your shoulders. The drape of the wrap reflected in the cafe case. You were pleased with how well it fell, but more so with the ease which with you made it happen. That girl in front of you kept tugging on her skirt. Too short, you thought, or perhaps too tight for comfort. You could see how ill-fitted it was on her, and you understood her unease. The skirt made her look like she was begging for attention not yet earned. If only giving informed advice wasn't seen as rude, you thought, you could help her in an instant. A simple A-line, of course, would do the trick. This obsession was seen every contour of a woman's body nowadays. You pitied the girl in a mentoring way. Sadly, you knew there was nothing you could say to her, so you conjured up images of Audrey as a princess gallivanting about Rome, her skirt's neat, clipped waist spreading into flowing layers of cool cotton. They were lovely to picture while you waited. The men who sat inside were different than the ones out on the patio. These inside men were conducting business, you noticed, by the attention they paid to their phones and the urgent voices they used with their table companions. But they did not stare at you in the same considerate way the cribbage men had. These men multitasked their gaze, their hands gesturing intensely while their eyes looked at you leisurely, as though they determined when you would leave. You found them distasteful, the way they took up space, the gluttonous monologue in their stares. You squared your body away from them, but turned your head so your own stare pierced them to the pleather backs of their chairs. "Stay where you are," your eyes said. Just as you moved up in line, a man caught your eye, sitting at a table close to the register. He was dressed in a slim-cut charcoal suit, a shade or two darker than his hair. He was tanned and vibrant-looking, a contrast from the self-important pastel-clad man across from him. No, this man struck you as different, and not just because of his appearance, though he was a satisfying mix between Eddie Fisher and Richard Burton. He looked at you differently, didn't he? He was appreciating of you, humbled in your presence in front of him. Not quite shy, he certainly didn't look away, but he looked like a man who knew you deserved the sort of affection and care that comes with high esteem. This man would get a little treat for treating you with respect. You tilted your shoulders and raised one hand, first to check your earrings, clip-ons from your grandmother's collection, a darling fanned cluster of gilded leaves held together by a single pearl, then down to the line of your collarbone, the epitome of an elegance lost long ago that was being nurtured back to glory in your every move, self-possession at its loveliest. And you were a woman who would not, no, a woman who refused to, live life steered by the judgment of others. The Eddie Richard man responded well to you, oh so well. He was transfixed, you could see, by the slight delay of his mouth, how it went slack when you'd first let your arm swan down towards your neckline, and how he'd felt embarrassed momentarily in letting his body react before his mind had the chance to remember decorum. You smiled to let him know you forgave him. "Beautiful day, isn't it?" he said. "A scorcher, but that blue sky never gets old," you replied. "I can't imagine anything but sunshine and cloudless skies following you anywhere, miss," he said. "Sappy," you thought, But it wasn't crude or asinine, so you let it slide. The way you laughed and rolled your eyes ever so slightly let him know how you felt about phrases such as that. You always kept a close hold on your dignity. Would you have done the same thing if a man your age, someone you couldn't picture in a Stenson in 35 millimeter, had responded in the same way? You should consider that. Next, please. The barista looked at you with a curious confusion, and you thought you were wasted on him. How could he possibly know anything about the woman coming into his focus? You judged him harshly, decided you would not teach him how to read you. This amateur you found wearying, too much work. You didn't have time for a boy like him because, for some reason, you were already tired. But from what? Had age sensed but not endured? Had you lived long enough yourself to be exhausted with youth? You leaned your body towards the bar, but tilted your head back at the Eddie Richard amalgamation and said liltingly, "Have a wonderful rest of your day, sir." The man couldn't contain his excitement, and you felt you had the world on a string. The barista peered at you like he was trying to understand, and in a moment of benevolence and a quick glance at his name tag, you said low and intimately, "Hello, Ben. A black coffee, if you'd be so kind." His eyes widened, and you laughed internally with abandon. How delightfully these men are bewitched, you thought. The question of whether there was a cruel streak to it all surfaced in your mind, but a moment's consideration ruled that out. It was necessary for survival, a move of Cleopatra. The barista fumbled through the rest of your order and the several orders following you, thrown, it seemed, by your allure. You hoped, with a twinge of guilt, that he would get his pace back. You needed to be getting back to the office. You slipped quickly back to the restroom to check your makeup. A face was very important, you believed, both inherently and with how it was kept. You stole a glance back at the handsome silver fox from earlier and was disappointed that he had turned back to his companion. Perhaps he was not as ensnared as you thought. The bathroom door clicked shut, and you were about to step forward when a shape on the floor caught your eye. It was a dragonfly, dead but in perfect condition just a few inches from the drain. Poor thing, you thought, what an awful place to die. The dim light picked up the aqua sheen of the poised wings held together by threads of dark vein. You considered how you might pick it up, but could not think of a way that didn't involve touching the bathroom floor. You shed a figurative tear and moved towards the mirror. It was then you heard the noise, the sound of something delicate scraping something hard. A neatly folded piece of paper was pushed under the door. You waited until the shadow of feet on the other side disappeared before gingerly pinching the paper with the tips of your fingers. You would wash your hands later. It was a note from him. It read, "To the beautiful lady in the white dress, from the man you charmed in the gray suit. You are an enchantment. You haunt me. Meet me at 17526 Portico Place. We have 23 rooms to choose from." You were stunned, somewhat disgusted, and a little flattered. You wondered whether these were the dignified responses a woman should have. This man was impudent, and you were not so easy to catch. Or perhaps his infatuation with you had happened that quickly. Had your pull been that great? You were obviously sophisticated, and he should have seen your respectability along with that. Was his note taking all this for granted, or was it written to recognize your singularity? Your grandmother's words came back to you as they had been for many years. "Honey, don't you for one second think you can actually change a man." But in your head, you couldn't help but respond, "Grandma, they haven't met me." You needed the mirror then. Your chin still pointy, jaw still rounded. Elegant if captured in the right way, uninteresting if not. Your eyes closer together than ideal, your nose unremarkable. Your lips, though, had a shapeliness that wore lipstick well. That much you liked. But you had worked hard on cultivating a stare with desire and longing, a stare that knew how to remain mysterious, a stare that knew how to blaze. A knock on the bathroom door, and you rushed with your lipstick. In your hurry, you stepped on the dragonfly. The flakes of its wings stuck to the bottom of your shoe, and you were first mortified, then angry, angry at the fragile thing for being so out of place. You brushed its wings from your shoe with a paper towel and thought, you brought this on yourself. You didn't need to be here. You approached your car, the sounds of traffic whizzing on Ventura in your ears, and thought again of work and your office just a mile away. You decided you'd tell them you'd had an off-site meeting that you'd forgotten to put on the calendar. No one would truly question you. You could get away with a lot. The steering wheel was hot when you got in the car, so you folded the note over it to keep from burning your fingers. You knew where Portico Place was because the streets on that side of Ventura were familiar. You knew where you were, not just by the repeated image of lush gardens behind wrought iron gates, but also the absence of noise. It cocooned your thoughts so you could focus. You asked yourself if you wanted sex this afternoon. The calm of the neighborhood lay over you like silk, and you began to like the idea of making love. You knew if he initially saw this as something as crude as fucking, you would be able to convince him otherwise. Portico Place approached, and you turned right down the street marked with a sign that said, "No outlet." The urge to give yourself over to desire began to fray as the scope of the unknown settled into your considerations. You mouthed the numbers as you drove past, 1744, 17498, 17512, as though saying the numbers was the way to acknowledge their existence. You stopped just past 17526, turned the car off, and sat there for a moment. The house was barely visible through the thick canas that stood guard behind the fence, but you could see what looked like the glass ceiling of an atrium on one side of the house and a railing along the roof, a patio perhaps. The looming outline of the house told you that he was not exaggerating when he'd said you would have a choice of 23 rooms. You thought of your hands pressed against the atrium window, the florets of steam your breath would make with each exhale, the sunlight falling along your arched back, how your passions would play out in every room, on the floor, against the walls, until it permeated the house, intense and real. And you would deepen into your own yearnings and come out of it blooming. All this would make him devoted. You walked toward the intercom by the entrance, held the copper box with both your hands, and stared at it as if it might transport you to that devotion. The screech of the gate beginning to open made you start, and a black car pulled out, empty except for a man in uniform at the wheel. You dropped your hands immediately and looked away as he pulled onto the street. Before he turned to drive off, the car stopped, and you lifted your head to see why. The man picked up your gaze with his own and held it for a moment, firm and supportive. You wondered how many other women's eyes he'd cradled like this, wondered if he pegged you as vulnerable, as needing something from another. He turned his head and left you alone with the question, was this your desperation? The car drove away. You stepped into the middle of the empty street and squared yourself to look down the driveway head-on as the gate closed, locking you out. The car turned out of sight and you returned to the intercom. The buttons held possibility and you felt power vibrating beneath them. You pushed the combination to call the main house, feeling the release of depressing each button. The gate began to slide and you waited until it was fully open to begin your walk down the driveway. Large trees still kept the house mostly hidden from view, but here is what you clearly saw in front of you. Days of deep blue, some of bright gold, others of vivid red. Days of color, colors of your choosing. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline Young, and I will be reading poems from a collection titled The Distance Formula. Basic meteorological concepts and other phenomena. As children, we twirled on grass, praised sunlight. Our skirts lifted, gave way to knees, then thighs. The sky was God, which asked for nothing. the bath. I float, roll from side to side, favor my right. Sometimes my nipples poke holes in the surface, come up for air. Below, a sea anemone, its many thin tentacles wave back and forth. When I shave my legs, short hairs float up. Eventually, they sink, like the excrement of small fish. I slip. Kepler's first law of planetary motion. Round and round we go, or is it more like an ellipse? I watched him one morning while he buzzed around up there, up where the mirror touches the ceiling. The couch in the hall cushioned the weight of his fall so that his body no longer became an anomaly for his wings. Latently. Each night before I fall asleep, thumbprint, loop, whorl, and arch, the world falls like a too heavy bowling ball and sleeps. You and I on the lowest branch, legs, feet. The theoretical foundations of nothing and everything. What if we could slip back into the womb, remove our everything from history altogether? Stars collapse under the pressure of their own weight, form black holes, sans time, sans space. Hotel Monte Vista. The neon sign burns somewhere out beyond Barstow, vacancy, like two bare arms stretched, Umber at his desk, measuring rotation curves for planetary nebulae. How to apologize and mean it. 1. Look up synonyms for the word apology. Note the following: gift, reason, whitewash, excuse. 2. Linger over the phrase mea culpa, the way it suggests cupped palms, an attempt to contain water or something longer. 3. Remove your coat, fashion it into a bowl, arm over wooled arm. How to do things with words. What does it do to confess when all that follows is more cruelty? As if we didn't have enough to carry. As if, in the act of confession, we were compelled to a reworking. Better the lie. Better the bottle whose letter remains untarnished by the sea. Primavera. To the left of the sternum, a tunnel, approximately horizontal, at the end of which lies a vortex of light. If peered through with one eye closed, you might be occupied by the way it seems to move, as if cyclical, searching for itself. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.